Factopia. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Innovation Center Danmark, Messecenter Herning og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia.
Du skal bare vide, at der er helt nøgne kroppe på din skærm, og det er nu. Tror I, at Muffe har tatoveringer på ballerne?
Er der noget, som I har fortrudt?
Jeg synes jo, jeg er pænere, når jeg ser sådan her ud.
Velkommen til jer fem dage. Og velkommen til de voksne. Muffe, når jeg lige kigger på dig, ikke? Så tænker jeg, at det kunne godt være, at du havde en tatovering eller to under morgenkåben også.
Det har jeg også, ja.
Femte A. Tror I, at Muffe har tatoveringer på ballerne? Prøv lige at række hånden op, hvis I tror det. Okay. Ja, det vender vi lige tilbage til, fordi i dag der skal det handle om kropsudsmykning. Hvorfor vil man ændre på sin krop? Hvor meget har det egentlig kostet, hvis man for eksempel er blevet tatoveret i over 1035 timer? Det vil altså sige i over 6 uger sammenlagt. Og kan man fortryde det? Velkommen til Ultrasmydertøjet. Nå, men nu tænker jeg egentlig, at vi skal i gang. Derfor så synes jeg, at vi smider morgenkåberne en af gangen. Og Tanja, vil du ikke starte og så måske fortælle, hvad du har gjort ved din krop?
I sidste uge, der opdagede den amerikanske avis The New York Times det danske børneprogram Ultra smider tøjet. I Ultra, der står 4 voksne danske mennesker og smider tøjet foran en gruppe skoleelever i 11-13 års alderen for at snakke om kropskultur. Det kan man i USA have svært ved at forstå. Men historien her, den giver os nemlig et fingerpeg om, hvorfor nøgne kroppe stort set er forsvundet fra internettet. Det skyldes nemlig amerikansk lovgivning, der simpelthen mere eller mindre har renset den slags bort fra nettet. Det er blandt andet derfor det, som dansk forfatter kan være svært at få lov til at offentliggøre billeder af nøgne hippier i Vesterhavet eller lignende ting på Facebook. Den estiske forsker Katrin Tidenberg har skrevet bogen Sex and Social Media sammen med Emily von der Nagel, en australsk forsker, og jeg ringede til hende og spurgte, hvad det her egentlig går ud på, og hvorfor amerikanerne har så meget imod nøgenbilleder på social media.
Right, so this is important because many of the kind of generic social media platforms that are really popular and heavily used are owned by American corporations. So they are subject to American law. And there is one piece of American legislation that in general is considered kind of the bedrock of not only the freedom of speech online, but also kind of general internet development and innovation. So there has been for the past 20 years or longer, sorry, this kind of belief that this piece of legislation is crucial in kind of driving innovation online. And this legislation is called Communication Decency Act. And in particular, it has this one section called Section 230, which has so far provided social media platforms what is usually referred to as safe harbor. So basically, in very simple terms, it says that social media platforms and other internet intermediaries are not responsible for content that their users put up there, right? So everyday users who, you know, post whatever they post there, the companies are not mandated to censor it. But even if they do in any way censor it, they don't lose their safe harbor, which means that they aren't legally responsible. Right. So SESTA FOSTA is a double bill that was passed in the U.S. Senate in 2018, I think. It is basically intended to fight against sexual trafficking. Which, you know, is a very important goal. But the problem is that one of the things that this law did was to say that if it seems that the content posted to social media platforms in any way might lead to sexual trafficking, then the platforms are responsible and can be held responsible. So in essence, the Sesta Fosta law for the first time went kind of and rewrote part of the section 230, which has been considered very crucial. And the problem was already before the bill was passed, critics were saying this is written so vaguely and the language is so unclear that this is going to lead to overreach or overregulation from the platform owners because they are afraid, right, that they might be considered responsible. So it's easier for them to just in case kind of throw out anything that can be considered sexually explicit because that's what can be construed as somehow leading to sexual trafficking. And even though all the critics and activists and academics who warned about this, they didn't change the language and they passed the bills. And that's exactly what happened. So many of the platforms kind of really tightened how they censor sexually explicit content, including some platforms that have been kind of legendarily relaxed about it. For example, Tumblr, which announced a complete ban of everything sexually explicit in December 2018, which radically changed the platform and they lost a lot of their user base and stuff like that.
Katrin Tidenberg, hun har skrevet bogen Sex and Social Media sammen med den australske forsker Emily van der Nagel, og den handler om, hvordan nøgne kroppe har fået trange kår på internettet.
My name is Katrin Tidenberg. I'm an associate professor of participatory culture at Tallinn University in Estonia, and I'm a social media researcher and have published some books on people's social media practices. Most recently, this book called Sex and Social Media with Emily van der Nagel.
Katrin Tidenbergs forskning den startede med, at hun forskede i sociale medier og specifikt kiggede på blog website Tumblr.
So I have been researching what people are doing on social media for about the past 10 years. And one of my earliest case studies was with people who had sex blogs on Tumblr. And while I was ostensibly researching identity, so that's how I ended up there. I wanted to kind of see how what people do online informs their sense of self and their identity. Because these people were having not safe work or kind of sexually explicit blogs, I also got a lot of material and information about their sexual practices and preferences and lifestyles. But then I mostly was kind of interpreting this data and publishing in regards of identity and visual self-presentation and selfies and all, communities and relationship making more broadly. Until last year, I think I realized, looking back over all of the material that I had amassed, that there was a lot from different studies that was about sex. And I hadn't made a kind of concentrated effort to discuss all of that material. And I felt that there was need, that there wasn't a nice kind of accessible but research-based discussion of sex and social media. And then I reached out to Emily, who's my colleague, and we know each other from the Association of Internet Researchers. We go to the same conference, and I knew that she had been studying kind of sexual practices online as well, and I asked her if she wanted to collaborate, and she did. And
men når man taler om de her sådan emner, hvad er det så egentlig vi taler om? Er det sådan helt eksplicit porno, eller er det bare folk der snakker om kropskultur ligesom i Ultra TV-programmet? When you call something sexually explicit, I mean, what do we talk about? Do we talk about pornography, or do we talk about nudity, or do we just talk about people doing selfies where there are sort of partly nude or totally nude, or what do we actually talk about?
So I'm purposefully using this term because it's very broad. So sexually explicit would kind of cover all of that, all of the things that you mentioned. The problem with it is exactly that it tends to, the SESTA-FOSTA bill and a lot of the kind of conversations about content moderation that follow from the bill or even before on social media platforms, they tend to conflate all these things, right? And kind of deem all of them as sensitive or adult or sexually explicit or not safe for work, and not pay attention to the fact that, you know, pornography is quite different from someone's body positive selfie posted for, you know, I don't know, fat acceptance or whatever else. But those are all kind of collapsed in the case of most of content moderation happening on social media, where it basically just goes based on what automated visual computation tools are capable of discerning, right? So it's like, how many percentages of what the machine thinks is bare human flesh is there on the picture? Or does the machine think it's a nipple? And does it think that it's a female nipple because men's nipples are for some reason allowed, whereas women's are not? And a lot of these other kind of fairly ridiculous rules have come from platforms fairly kind of rushed and haphazard attempts at operationalizing this law into their content moderation at such scale, where they have billions of users and just terabytes after terabytes of content flowing through their systems.
Mange af de mennesker, der mødes for at snakke om kropskultur, de finder faktisk sammen og danner sådan en slags fællesskaber på nettet, fuldstændig ligesom folk, der samler på frimærker eller motorcykler eller elektriske guitarer.
So both Emily and I have studied various communities like that on a bunch of different platforms, so Tumblr, Reddit, Instagram, etc. And what we've found at studies that have been conducted at various times, so something done 10 years ago and something done now, and on different platforms, is that people's motivations for doing it and what they say they get out of it tends to be very similar. So they say that why they do it is that they feel accepted and validated. So accepted in terms of perhaps their kind of sexual identity or sexual preference. So people who kind of get a lot of feedback from the mainstream cultural content and conversations that makes them feel that they might be weird, or what they like or what they are turned on might be weird. And they often share this experience that they feel they don't have anyone to talk to, or they have perhaps attempted to talk to their parents as young people and have been completely blocked and kind of told that, no, this is a bad thing. So then they feel bad about this. And when they find other people online, they feel this huge sense of relief that I'm not the only one, or it's not that weird, or it's not that perverse or whatever. Then in case of kind of visual content and posting pictures of yourself, there is a very strong kind of pattern that lots of people, I would go as far as to say majority of people at some point or another feel dissatisfied with how they look physically, because again, our kind of consumer economic system is built on making us feel that way, because then we will buy things. We will buy underwear that pulls our gut in, and we will buy gym memberships and tanning creams and etc. It's you know, oftentimes it's claimed that it's just women, but it's not just women. It is actually, you know, everyone today is being sold the dream of happiness, which can be reached when you look hot. So because of that, there is this kind of sense of freedom with and almost kind of therapeutic effect that accompanies being able to share pictures of yourself and other people telling you that you look nice, even when you don't look like a supermodel or someone you will see in a TV show. So these are very kind of basic human psychological needs. It's not internet specific per se. These are things that everybody needs. These are things why we create communities offline, and why people have always socialized with others. So it's just kind of repeated online and perhaps for some topics where it might be harder or riskier because the topics are stigmatized, to reach out to others in our everyday life to see if maybe they also like that particular sexual lifestyle or, you know, want to talk about how they feel about their body.
Men hvem er det egentlig, der deltager i de her fællesskaber på nettet?
So I don't have reliable statistics in terms of, you know, where I could generalize to a population where a study has been conducted and people have been asked. But based on kind of the cultural representations of, for example, taking naked selfies, and based on the various scandals that have accompanied data leaks or hacked iCloud pictures, we can say that it's quite common. It is definitely not rare and definitely not a minority experience. So the studies that have been conducted that are quantitative, not representative, but quantitative, have also found that quite a lot of people will say that they either have taken a sexy selfie or they have been sent a sexy selfie. And we can, of course, ask if there's a kind of the effect of social desirability in answering there, where if 80% of people say that I have been sent a sexy selfie, but 40% say they have taken a sexy selfie, we must ask whether the 40% just send them to everyone, or people are more inclined to say, oh, I've gotten one, and less inclined to confess that they have sent one.
And just to be clear about that, this is something different from dating online.
I mean, there's overlaps because let's put it like this. Not everybody who dates online necessarily takes and sends sexy selfies, but lots of people do. And not everybody who takes and shares sexy selfies does it in order to find a hookup or date, but lots of people do. So there's significant overlap, but they don't mandatorily go together.
Selvom mange af de samtaler, der foregår, de foregår med mennesker, som enten er anonyme eller bruger pseudonym, så er der faktisk mange, der danner tætte relationer, fortæller Katrin Tidenberg. Faktisk er der nogle af de mennesker, der møder hinanden på sociale medier, som sidenhen kommer til at danne par eller få meget lange venskaber i den fysiske verden.
Yes, they do. And again, this is something that my colleagues who have been researching how people use the internet for the past 30 years have found across different communities. So it's not sex specific. So people have been generating meaningful relationships in fandom communities and gaming communities. And it's the same for these kind of sexually explicit ones. And sometimes they do meet, like I have research participants who met on Tumblr and are married now and live together. So it's not a necessity that they never meet. But it's also not mandatory that they do meet. People have the capacity to kind of fill in the blanks for the information they don't know. And sometimes they even fill those in favorably. So when people omit certain information about themselves, but we like them, we think they're funny, or, you know, a nice person, then we tend to mentally fill in the blanks with nicer things. So the person we know might be nicer than the person they are in their everyday life.
So could you talk about these communities as sort of rooms of intimacy?
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't mean that everybody who uses this platform or everybody who belongs to this particular group has intimacy with everybody else. But it does mean that intimacy is possible, and many people do have intimacy. But I mean, intimacy is a result of something we do. It doesn't fall from the sky, right? So intimacy is a result of certain trust, and trust is a result of kind of self-revelation. You reveal something about yourself. And again, basic psychology says that if I tell you something that is kind of a secret, then you are compelled to tell me something that is kind of a secret. And if we exchange that back and forth, it builds trust and it builds intimacy. So basically, intimacy is a result of a communicational practice. And it can be accomplished in any form where people communicate.
Nu handler det her jo meget om nøgne kroppe, men spørgsmålet er, hvor kroppen egentlig er blevet af på nettet. Handler det om, at vi ikke har nogen krop, når vi bevæger os på nettet? Er det derfor, folk deltager i diskussioner og udveksler nøgenbilleder på nettet? Eller handler det om, at det at være menneske faktisk er dybt forankret i det at have en krop?
So, this is a really interesting topic for an internet researcher, because there have been these kind of waves of how internet researchers think about the body. So there was this kind of utopian enthusiasm in maybe the early 2000s about digital disembodiment, or this dream that we can leave our bodies behind and then just our pure minds or our kind of playing online, and that this would lead to this kind of democratization, right? Because if a lot of inequalities and discrimination are based on things that can be seen about our bodies, you know, what is the color of our skin, what is our gender, what is our weight and our age. So the hope was that if we don't see those things, everybody participates with just what they think and have to say. And then it did not happen. So a lot of research has shown that it is quite simple to kind of guess the body from how people communicate. So we kind of carry the experience of being an embodied being into how we communicate, even when we don't post pictures. Generally, currently, the consensus is that, you know, identities are embodied. So Descartes was wrong in his kind of separation of the body and mind. And because of that, whatever we do, even if it's text only, it's always embodied in how we experience it, how it makes us feel, how we use our body to experience the world and then describe or communicate based on those experiences. But obviously, you know, if you have video or photos, it's much easier. You don't have to kind of imagine a body or conjure up a body. And it, some people like it more, and other people say that, well, there is a lot of charm and a lot of kind of freedom in, for example, cybersex that is text-based, right? Where instead of maybe what's called camming, where you video, you have video picture of each other, and you can show your body and touch your body. You describe, right? You describe what you would do to the other person, and you describe what their body makes your body feel. And when done well, when done eloquently and poetically, people say that it can be immensely satisfying, and also just very creative. But, you know, we can't say that that form of communication is disembodied. The body is very much still there, being described, and being described as feeling things and then feeling things based on what you read on the screen.
And this is still possible.
It is still possible. And I mean, the kind of a lot of what is called sexting, so kind of one-on-one sexually explicit communication and interaction, is still possible on most platforms, because even Facebook or Instagram, that doesn't allow sexually explicit communication, they generally don't, at least yet, moderate what happens in private chats, right? So if it's just two users sending things back and forth, most of the time it's not kind of banned. But that is also the question of what kind of a role do we think that sex should play in a kind of normal, healthy life? Should it be a thing that is taboo and secret, or should it be something that is kind of that has a space within public discussions or public debate? And if increasing amounts of our public discussions move to social media, but then these corporations have the power to just eliminate certain topics from our public debate, then what does that do to our kind of everyday lives and broader, in a broader sense, our cultures and et cetera? So it's not just about being able to kind of privately share your sexy selfies with someone. It's about the kind of role that we presume that sex and sex education and representations of sex have or should have in just normal everyday life. So why do we think, like, why do we want our children to be educated by mainstream pornography, which we know teaches very harmful ideas of consent and satisfaction and how bodies look and what men do and what women do and, you know, all these things. Instead of, you know, on Tumblr, there were generations of young people who said that they got, that Tumblr was hugely pedagogical, that they learned so many things from content that seemed trivial. And so they learned at the same time about sex and bodies and body positivity and LGBT people's experiences and about their own experiences. But they also learned about politics and activism and agency and, I don't know, other countries in the world, etc. So the point is that the research we have has shown that sex is tends to be, and people want it to be, and people make it entangled in everything else. And you cannot cleanly cut it off and amputate it. And when you try, you end up throwing away or amputating a lot of creativity, a lot of things that are therapeutic to people who have issues, who have had horrible lives, who are discriminated against or marginalized. You end up throwing away a lot of kind of young people's self attempts to find themselves. And you end up throwing away a lot of stuff that is kind of political and pedagogical.
Som tidligere nævnt, så har udvekslingen af fotos og diskussionerne af kropskultur fået rigtig dårlige vilkår på nettet. Men det handler ikke kun om fotos, det handler også om hashtags. Bestemte hashtags er blevet forbudt eller kan simpelthen bare ikke bruges på for eksempel Instagram.
Right, so different platforms have again different policies about hashtags and about what they allow and they don't allow. But hashtags have been used both by kind of people to find each other and find other people who are interested in certain things, but they're also used for something, for example, that is colloquially called shadow banning, where let's say that the rules of a platform don't necessarily explicitly say that it's not allowed, but the platform has decided that it's not beneficial to make that type of content highly visible, either because they think their advertising clients won't like it or because they think that there are user groups who will mind. So they will then shadow ban it. It's not outright banned. It's not deleted. It's not taken off the platform. But it's made certain that it doesn't kind of show up in recommended feeds or when people search for certain things, that it doesn't end up high on the list of results. And with hashtags specifically, of course, there are also some hashtags that are not shadow banned, but explicitly banned. So people might hashtag something with a certain word, but when you search for it, nothing comes back. So it doesn't stop you at the point of posting. It stops you at the point of consuming this content and searching for this content.
But you also mentioned some hashtags that are sort of quite innocent, like hashtag curvy.
Right. So different platforms have experimented with banning or kind of shadow banning different hashtags. And they tend to tweak and tinker, so it changes a lot. But there have been cases where Instagram in particular, because Instagram is owned by Facebook and Facebook is kind of notoriously anti-sex, let's put it like that. So there have been cases where Instagram has banned all kinds of very mild words because they noticed that it tends to bring back a lot of content that can be considered explicit. So what probably happened was that a lot of people who took sexy selfies would hashtag them with a bunch of different words, including curvy. So they saw that curvy brought back a lot of kind of nudity or semi-nudity and decided to kind of make sure that it doesn't return results. There have been more scandalous examples as well with kind of LGBT or queer hashtags that have been banned, where again, you know, the initial impetus might have been that it returns a lot of sexual or pornographic content, but then an entire identity was you know, said that you are erasing our entire experience of life from the platform. But those usually then were brought back. So there was kind of backlash from the users. And oftentimes then platforms change what they have done. And Instagram has even at some point banned or made sure that searches for the eggplant emoji don't return things, because the eggplant emoji is often used in sexting or to kind of indicate a penis. So they even, you know, banned a little tiny picture of an eggplant, which is particularly funny, I think, in a tragic
way. Hvis man bevæger sig i social media kredse, hvor man udveksler nøgenbilleder, ja, så ved man også, at der er bestemt hashtag, der skal bruges. Det hedder nemlig SFW, Not Safe for Work. Det her er ikke sikkert på arbejdet. Hvilket betyder, at hvis du får noget tilsendt med det hashtag på, så skal du nok ikke åbne det, når dine kollegaer lige står og kigger med på skærmen.
Yeah. So NSFW is an acronym from Not Safe for Work. And it is actually quite old. It was initially, it can be considered one of those bottom up. So people came up with it. It wasn't platforms that kind of top down gave us this hashtag and then started limiting its visibility. It's bottom up, and people basically started labeling, not initially even in the hashtag form, but just you could put it in the email subject line, for example. And the point of it was, do not open this if there are people who can see your screen. For example, at work, right? So don't open it in the busy office. Open it after hours, or, you know, on your lunch break or whatever. And while it could obviously mean all kinds of content, right? It could mean violence or like unsavory jokes or whatever. It has kind of vernacularly or in folkloric use become associated mostly with sexually explicit. So if it's, you know, erotic or pornographic or somebody's naked, then it's most likely going to be labeled as not safe for work by users. And then platforms, of course, noticed this when hashtagging became available. People started using it, and platforms noticed this. And then they kind of took it over in their governance rhetoric. So Tumblr, for example, started saying in the rules, you know, we allow NSFW, but do this and this and that. Or then in December 2018, they said, we no longer allow any visual not safe for work content. And then they kind of particularly said that, you know, depictions of sex acts and what they called female presenting nipples, which everybody was quite confused about. And other things like that.
Nu lyder det alt sammen meget frækt, det her. Man kunne godt forestille sig, der fløj en masse tissemandsbilleder rundt på bredbåndet og i fibernettet, men der er faktisk også en vis form for etikette i de her kredse.
In terms of kind of sexual social media practices, and in particular image-based ones, we can also, like in other everyday practices, talk about consent and talk about kind of power and control and talk about basically abuse, right? So the fact that so many sexy selfies are empowering or kind of help represent bodies in different ways doesn't mean that they're all automatically good or that you should send them to people who didn't ask them. Nobody should. So it's not just, again, also about, you know, like men sending dick pics to women, although that tends to happen more often, right? But it's also about women shouldn't be sending unsolicited naked pictures to anyone either. So it comes back to not what's on the picture, but the basic premise of consent and kind of respect. So do not send people things that they haven't asked for, or you haven't asked, do you want it? Or had a conversation about, do you want it? And of course, there are some group-based things where there's the kind of explicit or tacit rules that if you come here, that's what we do, right? In this case, not everybody asks everybody else, hey, I'm going to post a naked picture. Are you okay with it? Because the rules of the space are, if you have already come to this kind of corner, then everybody's naked here. But even in those cases, kind of the basic idea of respect, consent, and not abusing your power remains the same.
So if you should use a metaphor for the physical life, I mean, it's like going to a nudist beach, which doesn't supposedly mean that you are going to have sex there, or...
Exactly. Exactly. That's a perfect metaphor. That, yeah, I have nothing to add. That is a perfect metaphor. You do not assume that you can grab people on a nude beach.
Spørgsmålet er så her til sidst. Hvad er der egentlig sket med alle de fællesskaber og alle de mennesker, som mødtes på for eksempel Tumblr for at snakke om kropskultur?
So some of them are dead. For example, the community on Tumblr that I researched for 10 years is mostly dead. Some of the people have moved to specific other platforms. Other people have just stopped using or doing these things that they did. It's very sad. The people that I do talk to still all say that they miss it. So it's been about 2 years and people still say that they miss it very often. Not every day, but every week. There is a moment where they think, oh, this is the type of thing that I would have posted on Tumblr or would have talked about with my Tumblr friends, and I no longer do. Other communities moved platforms. So there was a lot of people who went to Twitter, which is still quite relaxed about sexually explicit content. Then some people went to kind of specific sites. So we can even say that there might have been like an increase in people who create sexually explicit content as a form of sex work. So they initially didn't do it as sex work. They just did it as a hobby. They didn't want to make money off it, but they were popular. And then when they were thrown out of a generic social media platform, they went to something like OnlyFans or Patreon, where people subscribe to following you. So you make a certain amount of money from posting sexy selfies or writing sexy little stories. So it becomes a kind of digital sex work type of thing.
Ja, det var altså den estiske forsker Katrin Tidenberg, der har skrevet bogen Sex and Social Media sammen med Emily von der Nagel. Og selvom der står sex i titlen, så handler bogen jo altså langt hen ad vejen om ytringsfrihed. Du har lyttet til Techtopia. Du kan deltage i diskussionen om teknologi i vores Facebook-gruppe Techtopia Backstage. Du kan følge udsendelsen på Twitter på techtopia.dk, altså @techtopia.dk. Du kan skrive til mig på henrik@techtopia.dk. Og på techtopia.dk, der kan du også finde links til de ting, vi har talt om her i podcasten. Så vil jeg også lige gøre opmærksom på, at vi har en søsterpodcast, der sørger også hedder Techtopia, som udkommer på Radio 4 hver søndag kl. 13:05, og i øvrigt også kan findes som podcast på radio4.dk. Og den handler som regel om noget helt andet, end den her podcast gør. Så der er god grund til også at lytte til den. Techtopia. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Innovation Center Danmark, Messecenter Herning og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia. Techtopia.